Alright, hello everyone, welcome to episode 2 of the Very Very Gaming Show, VVG Show, episode 2, don't laugh. Don't know what this episode is going to be called, we'll make it up later. Joining me is Maya.
Hello.
Hey. Alright, so we're going to do the same thing as last week. First we're going to talk about some games. I believe that Maya has been playing some games, don't know what, and I'll talk about one or two. Then in the second half, we got some good content coming for you. We'll be talking about extortionate pricing for memory cards. And we'll be talking about this new phenomenon in Japan of Vocaloid music and Vocaloid music games.
A hologram dancing Japanese girl.
Dancing hologram Japanese girl.
Well, obviously she's not real, like an anime girl.
Did I miss out the hologram bit?
You did implies... completely miss out the hologram bit. Anyway, I was just filling that in for you.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
It's alright, someone needs to be on the ball.
We're also going to be talking about D by Kenji Eno, and we're going to talk a little bit about Kenji Eno's career. That will come after the second break. Alright, let's get on with it then. I'm going to start. Contra Shattered Soldier on the PS2. Sounds like it should be about a soldier in a state of post-traumatic stress.
Something really cool and fun like that.
Yeah, really great game concept. And if you think about the title as well, it sounds like what's being implied is that the soldier shat himself. That's the meaning of the word shattered.
Wow.
In my world.
That is incredibly London-esque. I mean, I don't think very many people in the world would go shattered as opposed to shitted. Or would even say that anyway, but...
Yeah, okay, it's a UK bit of lingo, but maybe it was something the Konami guys thought of when they did it.
Solid Snake has post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, in Metal Gear Solid 4, he's an old... Or maybe it's number 3, he's an old man, he's old grey, old snake.
I just wanted to put that in there.
Okay, so this is not about... Despite the title, it's not. It's very, very teenage. It opens with, like, Korn or Slipknot or some bollocks. Where you've got the... It's so funny, you have the main character. He's locked in a vault. They open the vault, and he's got long, greasy hair. He looks like 15 years old or something. And then all of a sudden, they run him through the marine windmill. The marine mill... And then out he pops and he's got a buzz cut.
The marine windmill. Is that the training program?
Yeah.
Running, you've got to survive this windmill, get in there.
Yeah, probably.
Make some flour.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, so he's got a buzz cut, he's all fit and all this rubbish. All played with this, what I call, butt rock going underneath it.
Butt rock?
Yeah, the whole game is like that. It's all filled with that stuff, right? But despite that, it's a really good game. It's a classic, very classic Contra kind of style thing. There are a lot of references to the older games. I especially saw loads to, well, what we know here in Europe as Super Probotector, but I think it's Contra 3, I think that's what it's called. It's the Super Nintendo one, anyway. So Shattered Soldier is quite unusual. It's in that it's a 2D... It's basically a straightforward sequel to kind of the Super Nintendo version. Obviously, it's a bit spruced up, but it's totally 2D. They didn't add any gimmicks.
It reminds me of a platformer.
Yeah, yeah. It's got the one thing that it does, I suppose, is a bit different. It makes use of the L... It basically uses every button on the PlayStation 2 controller, except for, you know, L3 and R3. You know, actually... clicking the analog sticks. It doesn't use the analog sticks. So you have 3 weapons that you can choose between. You have them accessible at all times. They've got unlimited ammo. You cycle through them with R1 and L1. And you can also do those kind of things where you can lock yourself in place and shoot your fire in all directions, or you can lock the direction of your fire and move your character around. And it is essential to master those. So it's quite a complex game in terms of the controls, and it takes a good while to get used to, because you have to learn how to do that stuff. But it's really traditional, which is really refreshing and kind of pleasant.
As a retro gamer, you'd have to say that.
Yeah, of course. Of course I would say that. And I suppose it doesn't really make sense for me to say that it is refreshing, given that we play mostly old games. So it's not refreshing because I'm not...
even mostly. We're constrained by the fact that the most recent console is PS2.
Yes. But it's a really good example of what you can do on a... like, what a newer console can bring to a really old genre, really old style of, you know, the run-and-gun kind of genre. It's a really gory game. Disgusting and...
green gunk, blood.
Yeah.
Weird. It reminds me slightly Silent Hill-esque creatures with the skinless...
they're always...
brains.
The thing about they're vomiting everywhere, always. There's constant vomit going on. But all the bosses vomit at you, and that's what you've got to dodge.
The teenage... basically, it's like if you, you know, after a night out... If you were Snake and it was a night out, that is basically what the game is. And you just have to avoid your the enemies, their vomit, because they're just so drunk. It's just, that's why I'm...
Contra Scatological Soldier.
Yeah, or as you said, Shattered Memories. Or
Shattered Soldier.
Whatever.
Well, I have shattered memories, yeah, from playing this game. But, yeah, it's pretty gory. But, I mean...
you found it really difficult, didn't you?
Oh, it is extremely difficult, just like the old games. But even more so, there's nothing... the first stage is quite easy. But after that, it really ramps up. And it takes a lot of memorization. There's constant bosses. There's about 5 or 6 bosses per stage.
Wow.
You're dealing with... there's only 4 main stages. And then you unlock a 5th stage, which has a treasure-esque boss rush.
It's Caribbean, at the end. Isn't it? Yeah.
What?
It's the Caribbean, isn't it? It's the final stage.
It looks like... well, it's a jungle of some...
it's got the tropics. It's got those yeah. The guys are like admiral soldiers.
It's called Archipelago.
That's why I thought it was the Caribbean.
It doesn't mean anything to me. What is that?
It just means collection of islands, which and usually when you say that, it means Caribbean.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So God.
Well, yeah, possibly.
Didn't you say that, I mean, how many continues and lives do you have when it's easy and when it's normal?
Well, easy is essentially like a practice mode. So you have 99 credits and you've got 8 lives per credit. So you're not really in any danger. I mean, it's hard, but it's not that hard. What happens is you beat it on easy. The game, just like all the old Contra games, doesn't actually let you beat it.
It's a dick, basically.
Yeah, yeah, it's a total dick. It comes up saying, you know, thanks for playing. Now, if you want the real ending... well, if you want any ending, come back on normal mode. Normal mode, by contrast, has only 3 credits. And instead of having 8 lives per credit, you have 2 lives per credit. I've tried it.
You have 3 credits, is that right?
3 credits, 2 lives. Oh, okay. Yeah, so... I can make it through the first stage easily enough without losing a credit. Can't do it without losing a life. Then to go on and beat these other stages, which are all get progressively harder, is going to take a lot of practice.
Mm.
So I actually want to. I'm going to try it. I mean, the game is good. It's fairly fair. You know, when you die, it's your fault.
It's so like masochistic.
It is. But look at it this way. It's not... the difficulty is not an issue. What is an issue is when there is something that you cannot anticipate, when there is something that is totally random, is totally unavoidable, which is what a lot of old arcade games used to do. They used to be very cheap.
Put more coins in.
Yeah, exactly. But this is very much a very skill-based exercise, and it's ludicrously difficult, but it's good, and I really enjoy it.
You're a masochist. That is basically the bottom line to that. I can't watch whilst you're playing. I find it too tense. But at the same time, I actually really appreciate that it's a good game because it requires a level of precision and it looks like it's fun to play, especially if you've got 2 players, which I think it makes it more difficult if you've got 2 players.
It does. That's actually a small problem. Yeah, the 2-player mode, they balance it. So they don't change anything about your weapons or anything like that, but all the bosses have more health. If one person dies, loses all their lives, that's it. They're out. And the one person has to continue until they lose all their lives and continue or
and
do whatever.
And the bosses keep their high up health?
Yes, they do.
Oh,
they do.
God, okay.
So that makes it more difficult there. Mm. The other thing, the reason why it's annoying is because of that change in the, I guess you would say, the stuff of the game. You can't drop in and drop out with 2 players or 1 player. You have to select 2 players at the menu. If you get 3 stages into the game and then your friend comes in and says, hey, I want to play... by the way, you can't save or continue. So if you're at stage 3 and then your friend comes in and says, hey, can I join? Oh, well, yeah, you can join in, but I'm going to have to restart the game. And then also, if you start in 2 players, then also the same thing. That second player can't drop out. they have to stay in until you reset the game.
So it's quite inflexible. But then it's quite a short game.
Even though it only has 4 or 5 stages, if you were an expert, you could blast through the whole game in less than half an hour. It took me to beat it. I mean, this was with took me a couple of attempts, you know, because I would stop at a certain point or whatever. But I played for about 4.5 hours, 5 hours before I actually got to the end on easy. And that's not even the ending, because it takes a lot of memorization, a lot of skill. The only other thing that I would mention about it, just as a kind of footnote to what I said earlier about the story and the opening cutscene, is the production values are awful. Like, there's no voice acting, and the things they say is that B-movie dialogue. It seems even more awkward because you're reading it awkward. And one detail that I really love is that the main villain that you're fighting is called Lance Bean. Right? So the villain of the game, his name is Mr. Bean. Right, he's supposed to be threatening. I'm supposed to be menaced by Mr. Bean. Come on, guys. What were Konami smoking? Mr. Bean.
Clearly they were avoiding all the vomit from the morning after.
That was probably them. Maybe that's what the game is based on.
It's
their nights out. Nights out at the Konami HQ.
It's based on morning after in the office.
Yeah.
Run away from Mr. Beach.
They clearly took the piss out of some ugly prick in the office because...
The
turtle boss. There's a turtle boss, I think it's in the first stage of Contra 3 or Super Probotector. What happens, you beat him, and then all of a sudden the turtle turns round to reveal this hideous face on the back. He vomits at you through his mouth, and then he sprays mosquitoes and fleas and stuff out of his nose.
Oh, it's all the plague, basically.
Yeah. What happened, it's funny when you beat the bosses, they don't explode, well, most of them don't explode. They just sort of wither away in their own gunk, and they're just there bleeding
that
green stuff.
Rather biblical. Plague, mosquitoes, withering away.
It's the Bible set to corn.
Exactly, that's quite common. What do you think goths are?
Okay, Maya. All right, let's keep it real. Let's move on. Maya, what you
to
got?
To another biblical... A game of biblical proportions.
Whoa.
Civilization 2.
Sid Meier's Civilization 2. Does it have Sid Meier in
Actually,
no, I don't think it does.
No.
Alright, Civilization 2, it's a turn-based strategy game.
Yeah.
You start the game with a bunch of just a pilgrim settler. It's in the set in about, 2000 BC is when you start. You build up your cities, you build up your infrastructure, your economy, your military, and so on. And you play the game through until around 2020 AD. And in that, during the meantime, you know, you face other empires, you compete, try and grab the land, try and make your citizens happy, they might revolt, and you gain kind of historical, you gain knowledge. And
I think a big part of underpinning it is the resources. Like, the more and more you understand the game, the more and more you can exploit the location of a city, exploit the fact that you're next to the ocean so you can make loads of ships, exploit the fact that you're next to loads of mountains so you can make trade routes using caravans or freights or railways and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I've been watching you play a lot of it. It is a really good game. Neither of us really have hardly any experience with strategy games before, so this is a bit of a new one, even though it's turn-based, isn't it?
Do you know what it really reminds me of playing with is ActRaiser. Something about the balance between the action and raising the towns and making them happy, and you know, the kind of cross-fertilisation in the towns and all that stuff. Obviously Civilization is a very different game because there isn't any of the kind of action component,
but you have war, right?
But you have war and
war is, I mean, it's not an action component necessarily, but it does,
it provides some spice.
Yeah.
So just building up your town and stuff. The reason why I think it's so addictive is just that aspect of it, of just making your towns just a bit better, the kind of empire side of it, just getting your town to be your towns and your empire to become bigger and bigger and better and better, and fighting and all that stuff. It's really good, but at the same time, I think I'm slightly growing weary of it, and I would quite like to try Civilization 4 because I've heard bad things about Civilization 3.
I mean, how long would you say that you've played Civ 2?
Oh my god, Well, it depends. Do you want like amount of days or amount of hours? Because if I told you how many hours, it's actually quite bad considering the amount of time. Because I've been playing like at least 4 or 5 hours every single evening since I started.
Woof.
It's so addictive. It's for a completionist like myself. It is so addictive. I'm actually just struggling trying to describe it because in my head I can just see the little figures walking, irrigating the land. You know, and then you've got some of my soldiers just attacking Spain for whatever reason, and then you know, I feel slightly bad because I just think, oh, you know, I'm a communist nation making all these, you know, causing all these wars and creating all this havoc. But at the same time, it's just ruthless part of me is just enjoying every second of it. Yeah, I'm not crazy.
Okay, so basically it's a game well suited to a crazy person like yourself.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I like about it is the way your character, the kind of place that you inhabit, because you obviously choose the type of government. Was it monarchy?
Republic. Democracy, communism.
Fundamentalism. You change the different types of government, but obviously you never change as the player. And you always have the same set of advisors and yeah. Everything. Nothing really changes.
Well, their outfits change.
Yeah, their outfits change. Great. But don't their outfits just change with the times anyway. It doesn't matter what sort of government
you
have, does it?
But yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, quite educational in that it makes you really, really think quite hard about economics and the kind of amount of kind of decisions that politicians must make, even though it's just really stupid that I'm saying this. But it really does make you think of those things. And then part of me was a bit confused about some of the omissions the game made. Like, it didn't talk about the Ottoman or Islamic Empire, inverted commas.
Well, we established that Civilization 4 does have Arabs.
Arabs. Yeah, but Arabs was never an empire. Arab is just, you know, a set of an ethnic group or race.
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, I can see why they
because
they
I
didn't
feel like
to
in
call
this
it.
Game, fundamentalism is just byword for, you know, those religious Islamic types.
Yeah, obviously. It's Iran, is it basically, right?
No, because Persians are Iran.
No. I mean
modern day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Or Islamic Republic, Pakistan, maybe. I don't know.
No, Pakistan, no.
But it makes sense in a way. They use Arabs, I know, in Civ 4, but the starting cities are Mecca and Medina, so it's pretty obvious, really, what it's really referring to.
There was that modded. What was that? Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
That fan made game.
I think it's called Sword of Islam.
Oh my! Really? Yeah, wow! They really went all out.
Yeah, it's a mod or it's a total conversion, something like that.
Okay.
But anyway, we don't have Civilization 4. Maybe we should. I
value my life too much to buy another Civilization because I'm seriously so addicted to just making these empires sort of rise and fall and all this. I just don't think I could. I don't think I want to. I'm just too scared.
Fair enough. Well, we know someone who has been playing Civilization for years. And it's like his go-to game, and his girlfriend doesn't like it.
Well, I can see why, because, you know, I mean, the amount of days where I've just been like, oh, I'll just play for an hour, it can never be an hour, because, you know, some barbarians have taken over one city, and then you're like, oh my god, everyone's so unhappy for some reason, I need to, like, irrigate my land and make roads and increase the trade, and then suddenly you realise your whole evening, it's 2 a.m. in the morning, you've done nothing, the whole evening, nothing, except make your game better or whatever. And then, you know,
you made roads, you developed refrigeration.
Yeah, you increase your sciences, you increase your research, you do whatever you need to do to make your towns the best or whatever. And it's so bad because it just gives you such an amazing feeling. It just makes the despot in all of us happy. That's what it is.
So, like you said, a good one for control freaks. Like yourself.
Did I say control freaks? I think I said completionist.
Oh, sorry. What's the difference, honestly?
Okay, actually, good point. You know, well, at least we're doing it in games and not in the real world. Look at it that way.
All right, good way to look at it. All right, so is that all you've got to say about
this? I genuinely can't think of anything else to say about it. I think I'm too in the zone.
I was going to say, yeah, for a game that you've played so much, it's kind of remarkable that...
It's made brain dead. It's killed all the brain cells.
There's your endorsement right
there.
Great
advertising for the game.
There's the box quote.
Yeah. Turns you into a Civilization zombie.
Oh, you know, actually the one thing other thing that I wanted to mention about it. Back when we first got it, you know, I wrote a post on the blog where I made fun of a review of Civilization 2 that said that if this game had better graphics, it would be a must-buy. And I made fun of that because it sounded to me ridiculous, you know, if this game had better graphics. As if graphics were the only thing that really... that make a game a must-buy. But actually, from playing it, now I actually understand what it means. Because
it's a strategy game, the fact that the graphics are a little bit outdated, just inaccurate, it's hard to read the map.
Yes. So it's not that it's dated, it's that the map is hard to read. Obviously, ActRaiser has a map, but ActRaiser's map is not hard to read because of the way it's been designed. It's been designed differently. I think with Civilization, it was designed for PC. Shrinking it down into the PlayStation kind of resolution, the resolution for TV is 10 times smaller from the PC. So everything that worked on the PC, everything that was uncluttered on the PC and looked fine, is cluttered and not fine on the PlayStation. Mm. And it does look different. They did take steps to make it look better and improve the interface. But there are still certain aspects of the map in particular that it's hard to read.
When you're moving characters along the railroads you've made, it's hard to tell if they're on them or not.
Yeah, there's things like that. And also there are kind of mineral resources, and they all each have a symbol that's allocated. But because the symbols are so small, they're really quite difficult to read. Mm. And there's also a kind of map of your town and all the resources that are there. And because it just has to pack in so much information into a very small space and pack loads in there, it just can barely do it, or it can't do it. Mm-hmm. The icons end up being so small that you're kind of lost as to what is going on. And I'm making this sound like it's a major point. It's not. It's quite a minor thing, but I do understand why
people would complain.
Yeah, why they felt it was necessary to bring it up, because it does slightly make things a little bit more difficult than they need to be.
Mm.
All right. So I think that's it for Civ 2. Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be jumping on that community stuff. Don't try and keep us away. Don't switch us off. Okay, going to the break now. It's break time. Alright, welcome back everyone. Yeah, let's kick it off. Then we're going to talk about a blog post from a blog which I've only just started following. It's called Why Didn't I Complete It? A blog about a completion phobe.
Sworn enemy to me.
Right, so this post is about the Vita, which neither of us have.
Or really want to have.
We don't really anticipate getting it. But the reason why I bring it up, I actually just wanted to kind of pick up a point that he makes, which I found shocking, and just kind of broaden it into a discussion about...
I love that. You found it shocking.
It's genuinely shocking. I'm just going to read it and then we'll take it from there, right?
Okay.
In this post, he's just saying that the Vita is... it's had a redesign, and so it's better than it was before. You know, they've changed the button placement or stuff like that. But he says the reason why it's almost perfect and not exclusively perfect is because the memory cards are the most overpriced piece of video game accessory in the history of the genre. You can buy each game on a cartridge, but if you want to take advantage of PlayStation Plus, which, if you follow the current news, obviously PlayStation Plus seems to be the thing to follow because you get all these free games, you need a memory card. Not only are they always running out on Amazon and in physical shops, a 64 gig card costs £85.
Stop, stop, my ears are bleeding, stop.
A 64 gigabyte micro SD card costs £32. That is less than half.
Shameful. Shameful.
Sony are bad guys for doing this. The fact that the Vita isn't that popular saves them from the daily thrashing they should be receiving for stealing money from their customers. £85. The equivalent of...
You could buy a new one for that, is what I'm going to say.
Well, pretty much. I mean, what is that? That's the equivalent in dollars of $100, $120. mean, that is insane. I mean, we actually just bought a new old secondhand memory card for the PS1, an official one, because of Civilization. Because Civilization
takes up ten blocks,
and that's essentially the whole of a memory card.
Mm.
We paid £6 for it, and yeah, it's 1 megabyte big, which is, you know, laughable today. But obviously then, back then, you had an excuse for it was necessary to use proprietary memory card systems because there was no standard. But today, you've got SD cards, which are standard.
Mm.
And SD cards are multi-use. You can use them in your digital camera and whatnot. Buying a PSP memory card is something you can only use on a PSP. And to charge £85?
It's just like they were like, you know, let's work on making the Vita better, but let's just think of another way of just making loads of money on a handheld console that completely bombed.
Look, memory cards, they've always been a kind of hidden cost component of a console.
Well, yeah, I know, but like as you said, £6.
£6, we're getting secondhand. At the time, it's not sure about PlayStation, but
25?
15.
Yeah, 15 it could pounds. Go up to quite expensive. This is true.
And like I said, it's a hidden cost, but £85,
you could buy a new secondhand PS2. You could buy a Wii with that.
I'm actually going to look and I'm going to see how much, if we could get it just on eBay,
mm-hmm.
See what's going on. I mean, I'm sure the Vita's, you know, fine, but...
What do you mean it's fine? I've heard such bad things about it.
Well, it's not doing well, but it's doing well. And given that it's doing so poorly compared to the 3DS, it does have a lot of games. So who knows? Maybe the PSP Vita is going to be the next Saturn.
Oh, I love the expression on your face right now. Whenever I say a Vita, it just makes me sound like it's I'm drinking, you know, go buy some Evita water.
There is, because it's Evita, isn't it, like crackers or... No, it's not crackers, it's a health...
Yeah, it just sounds, but it sounds like water, doesn't it? Yeah. Go buy your Evita water so that you can, you know, run 1,000 miles. Evita. I don't know who thought of the name of it, but I think...
Maybe you're supposed to say it Vita, it's more like, you know, vitality or something.
Terrible.
This is secondhand. Here's one. It sold new for £83 plus 2 games. So you're paying, you're paying double the price. It's absurd. Sony, you're scum. So the other reason why I wanted to mention that as well is because, you know, we've got a Saturn, and the Saturn has quite an original and really interesting way of dealing with game saves. When we first got it, I actually thought it sounded amazing. It sounded really good. And now I see it's actually kind of annoying and broken. I actually wish they'd just gone with a quite straightforward memory card thing.
In what way is it broken?
Well, you have the internal memory, which comes with the system, which runs off a calculator battery or a watch battery, one of these little disc ones. Problem is, when that battery runs out, your game saves disappear. The battery, in theory, should last for a long time, but once it runs out, it's gone, which is really annoying. What you can do, then, and this is the kind of alternative, it's weird that they would make it an alternative, it's weird that it wouldn't just be there, and that wouldn't be the only thing, is they have a cartridge, a memory cartridge, which goes in the top of the console. I got one recently from that retro game fair for £10, and I thought, you know, great, this is the permanent solution, this is the one that will, you know, there'll be no more problems now. The other
problem... It just sounds like you're talking about a relationship.
It does, doesn't it? The other problem, actually, sorry, with the internal memory is that it's quite small as well. So it fills up quite quickly, especially depending on the sort of games. If you're playing RPGs, then it fills up very fast. Then the problem then with this, with the car, it sounds great. I stuck it in, it didn't work. I fiddled with it. I had apparently what the Saturn is very bad at detecting it. So you have to fiddle with it, get it in the right position. When it makes contact and you can finally access it, yeah, leave it and don't touch it. It's so sensitive. That's annoying. Because, it started off fine. I could save to it, and you can copy stuff between the internal memory and the cart.
The external one, yeah.
Which sort of sounds like, okay, I don't really see why I'd need to do that, but okay. Because a lot of games let you save directly onto the cart. Then I found the problem was in certain games, I would try and save directly onto the cart, and it would crash. The Saturn would just freeze. And I'd have to shut down, and then I would lose my save file. And that was so annoying. So what you have to do, it forces you to manage it, even though you have space. What I can do is I can save to the internal memory, but if I want it to be permanent, I have to copy it to the cartridge, and then I can't save it directly onto the cartridge. And every game varies as well in how they do it. Some games will let you access the cartridge directly, other games won't. So they just it just ended up being...
Oh, stop it. You know, after all that, I should have lost will to live, basically.
they just made it needlessly complicated. And much more.
But then that is basically, should be the tagline of the Sega Saturn, needlessly complicated. Because it basically destroyed itself by being too complicated for all the time that it was. Because it has the two processors.
Yeah. Do you know in Virtua Fighter 2, they set it up so that each processor generated each character? I'm sure we'll get into it, you know, more
in later episodes.
But they really made some really weird decisions and really out there.
We need to talk
stuff.
About this some other time because Christmas I have so many things to say about this. But yeah.
Yeah.
On to the next post.
The Saturn is a zombie. That's all I have to say.
Frankenstein.
Sorry, that's the one, yeah. I think the PS2 handles memory quite well.
No, I think it's great.
The memory cards are big. You don't run out of... I've never run out of space on a PS2 memory card.
It's just generally quite nice to the person who's bought it. It's not too expensive.
You know, the N64 ones are interesting. They vary. Some of them save directly on the cartridge. Specifically Nintendo games, they just let you save on the cartridge. And third-party games, they would have to pay extra for that feature. So most people didn't, obviously. And you had to get a memory card. And the memory card goes in the controller, you know, in the back. So that was really unusual. All right, moving on. This is from one of my favourite blogs from Reset Tears. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation. I wonder if it was Reseteer. There's a game called Reseteer. Or a series or something called Reseteer. So he's posted this post called A Severe Case of the Vocaloids, where he talks about a new game on the Vita. Well, this is turning into the Vita podcast.
Not that should ever exist, but yeah, go on.
So this game is called Project Diva F. And the reason why I want to bring it up is because it is about this phenomenon called the Vocaloid. So essentially the kind of history behind it, I'm just going to paraphrase from the post here. Vocaloid was a piece of software that was invented in Japan, which let people kind of create songs using pre-recorded sounds of people's voices. So computerized voice software, just like kind of auto-tune that you make yourself. And then a genius came up with the idea of slapping an anime character on the box and making songs from that, from said person. And now... According to ResetTears, the company has enough fat stacks of cash to buy all of Japan. There's a whole bunch of Vocaloid characters at this point, but the most well-known is undoubtedly Hatsune Miku, the girl famous for swinging a leek around, providing vocals for that flying rainbow cat.
Isn't there like a Pokemon that does that?
What, flying rainbow?
No, the leek.
Swinging a leek.
Yeah, of course there is. What's it called? Not Psyduck, but the other... Anyway, whatever, you can look it up later.
Each of these bits that I'm reading has a link to a video of some sort. So there's a video of this swinging a leek around, but we can check it out. Or you can check it out, listener. Providing vocals like Flying Rainbow Cat and literally performing in live concerts as some kind of hologram. What a time to be alive.
Do you think that ResetTears is taking the piss?
Oh, when he says what time to be alive, yes, he is taking the piss. We've seen this concert is freaky.
I think I find the crowd's reaction extremely disturbing. When I first heard it, I thought, oh God, Japan. And then I was like, actually, the UK had the Gorillaz, and you should look that up if you want to, which is basically, was it Blur's or...
It wasn't Blur, but it was the lead singer, Damon Albarn,
art project.
Some other people as well.
Who they used cartoon characters to sort of made it quite a successful band.
Very successful.
With good music and relatively good music, and it was quite it was quite innovative. So it's not like Japan, but I guess what I find really freaky about it is the girl looks extremely emaciated, over large, and just this bizarre mishmash of...
What do you mean, over large?
She doesn't look like a normal-sized girl.
Because her legs are, like, 10 feet long. She's just an anime, typical sort of skinny anime girl.
So, I have problems with typical anime girl.
I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm just saying, that's what she is.
I found it disturbing because of Kyle's reaction towards her. And
Wait. Let's describe this concert first.
Sorry, go on.
So, it is a 3D hologram of this girl, thing, creature, in quotation marks, her, singing these computerised vocals.
Which fans, mate?
I'll just read a little bit more of this then. Other characters featured in this Hatsune Miku Project Diva F video game have also become incredibly popular, and over the years their respective computer programs have advanced significantly. Some songs you can barely even tell that it's a computer singing, or maybe I'm just losing it. What's best about the world of Vocaloid, though, is how its entire existence essentially stems from the fans. The fans create the catchy songs, they draw art of the characters, they create full-blown animated music videos, they write stories based on those videos, and they make comics and figurines and video games and anything else they can come up with. There's practically no official canon for the characters, so anything and everything is created, and the amount of creativity put into so much of this is quite staggering at times. And if just talking about the music itself, I found it neat how songs of every genre of music has been crafted from these computer programs. The sheer variety to be found is impressive, and in fact as well as a strong positive in Project Diva F as well. Project Diva F is the Vita game in particular, which is just a music sort of dance hero. I don't even know what sort of guitar hero with vocals. Whatever.
I was going to say, on the other hand, I do think that the fan input and the fact that the fans are making it kind of awesome. But Japanese fans scare me. So, because it's just like the commitment, but also it's just this level of just kind of slightly, you know, scary level of, I mean, I've had this. I mean, everyone has something that they're kind of obsessed with. Like, obviously, I was a massive fan of Harry Potter when I was younger.
Nerd.
Oh, sorry, hang on. Why are you insulting me for being a nerd? I thought this was a safe space.
Safe space, get out of here.
Oh, anyway. Whatever, you know, everyone has a little thing. And then I think it's nice that it's quite democratic, isn't it? Like, to have people making stuff and being creative and stuff like that. But then it's just really disturbing to watch a concert because all these people with those light, I can't remember.
Glowing.
Glow sticks, that's it.
Yeah.
Just in unison, just. And this fake person. Basically, it reminded me of Big Brother. It reminded me of the George Orwell's 1984 novel. just these people worshipping this thing that isn't real, isn't there. Which obviously, you know, video games, are they real? We cannot have this argument all day long. But there's something about her that made me feel like we've reached a very bizarre stage in our human existence.
But obviously the popularity of autotune tells you that things have been moving in this direction for quite a long time.
We could have a discussion about Will.i.am right now and how his whole career is based upon I'm the future, I'm robot, blah blah blah.
Yeah,
I don't buy it. I think that I'm one of those people that are quite conservative about it because I just feel like you have to be aware, are you in control of the technology or is it in control of you? And I don't think that we're in control of it anymore. That's my opinion. I think it's the opiate of the masses.
You're saying this on a video game podcast. Technology is the opiate of the masses.
Well, no. I think.
Excuse me while I get back to Civilization 2 right now.
No, I'm part of the machine. It's not that. I just think that. I think that's why I like retro games because I think feel like you're still, you know, the development hasn't got to a stage where it's just about numbing your brain completely. That's just what I think. I think there is a level of kind of. I think you can enjoy technology, but I think there's a stage when it gets too much. That's
okay. Well, I guess that's about it, really, on that. I don't really know quite what I thought our conversation would end up being like, but I just really felt the need to mention it, to bring it up, because it's so weird.
Hmm.
Okay, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about Kenji Eno and D. Okay, everyone, welcome back to the show. We're going to have a little chat about Kenji Eno and the game D, which is our new favourite game. No. Okay, but let's talk a bit about Kenji Eno first. We'll see how this goes. If we like it, we might turn this into a regular feature.
No, but you want to turn what into a regular feature? You want to talk about game makers?
No, I want to talk about D as a regular feature.
I don't think there's that much material in a two-hour game that you can't pause to re-discuss in every single episode. I guess you could, but I'm not sure how I'll...
You're right. There's no pause screen. How can we have an adequate discussion when there's no pause screen? Right. Anyway, no, we're going to talk about our favourite game developers and, you know, pick out one or two specific games.
Favourite, just interesting.
Interesting, yeah, crazy.
You know, I think, you know, Warp, don't think it's a favourite.
No, it's not a favourite of ours. It's probably a favourite of some people's.
I don't think so. I don't think even Warp probably...
even like their own games. Right. Okay. Well, anyway, let's get into Kenji Ino. And so Kenji Ino is best known for his company that he started called Warp. I mean, they made a couple of bizarre games, casual kind of games. There was a Mahjong title. D was kind of the first big hit. A big hit, especially in Japan, sold over 1 million copies. It was pretty successful here in Europe and also in America. It did well. Well, we'll go. Actually, I'll come back to D later, and we'll talk more about it in depth. But after D, he made a mini game collection called Short Warp for the 3DO, which was a sort of kind of mini game compilation of kind of previous games that he'd done and a few extras, and that was sold with condoms. And there were only 10,000 copies made, all of them hand-signed by Kenji Ino. That boy must have a strong wrist. Then, after that, he made Enemy Zero, which has, for Saturn and PC, that's got invisible enemies in it. You detect their presence with sound. Very difficult game. After that, Real Sound, which was a game designed for blind people, so it had no graphics at all. So it's a kind of adventure game. That was originally for Saturn, but then he also re-released it for Dreamcast. This time it had photography taken by Kenji Ino in it. Very nice. Okay. And then his final game, well, I should say his last but one, his final game then, his penultimate title was D2 on the Dreamcast. Then he left games for years and years. He came back and he made a WiiWare game. I don't remember what it was called.
Mew, Me and the Cube.
There you go. Yeah, that was a sort of puzzle. That was quite a conventional game, wasn't it, that one?
Yeah, but I thought it was, he was basically, I think he got it into his head about how, you know, the controller and the kind of... That's what I really like about him, is that he's very interested in the kind of mechanical side of it and then how to make games that are weird, that go with the mechanics. So with Yumi and the Cube, it's all about tilting cubes, right?
Mm.
And making new things that you can tilt on a cube, which obviously goes really well with the Wii system.
Yeah, it's like a very simple version of Boom Blocks.
Yeah.
And then he died, unfortunately.
Yeah, of high blood pressure.
Yeah, and he was quite young, wasn't he? In his 40s.
Yeah, I think he was in his mid-40s.
Yeah. Going back a bit, for the Real Sound, he was going to make it for the PlayStation. And then he announced at the press conference that he was going to change to Sega. And he had a Sony or a PlayStation logo up on a projector in front of the press, in front of the media. At a Sony event, it morphed into a Sega logo. And the Sega president came, his voice came on and said, "Welcome to Sega."
And all the journalists were like really confused.
Yeah, as you can imagine. That caused a big stir. So I guess that's kind of where he gets his sort of reputation for being a kind of oddball, aside from his games themselves.
Yeah, but. I mean, this is the reason why. I mean, I've been pestering you so that we can talk about Kenji for quite a long time, because I love him. Like, I think, I mean, I'm not a massive fan of his games, although having watched, not played, D, I really like it. It's not really about that, it's more about the mythology, because he has a personality, and like the only reason that you have a personality, also sort of that you're well known in the game community, like as a game maker, is if you're amazing, got a creative vision, you have a personality, Kenji Ino, or you're a girl who's good looking, i.e. Jade from Assassin's Creed.
Raymond, I think it is.
I didn't. All I can remember is her pretty, pretty face, which is probably the point.
Yeah, well, she was just used for the marketing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure to some extent Kenji Ino was, I'm not saying that he was doing this entirely for kind of cynical reasons, but it is a good marketing draw. One of the things that he did with D, he did all the cutscenes, designed them and created them on his own, and without telling anyone in the team, he added them after it had already gone to the censors, the rating board. I'm not even sure if there was a kind of rating board back then. I think it just needed to be approved by the console makers. He submitted it without any cutscenes, and it got given a teen rating in America. And then he deliberately engineered it so that after they gave the rating, after they approved, he then replaced it with his own copy with the cutscenes. And that is why, and then the game gained notoriety in part, or probably exclusively.
And the most loved reaction of the company. It was like, no one was like, what the hell are you doing? Why don't you tell anyone? They were like, you know, good call. Now it's going to be really famous. And they were right. They kind of just went along with it, which shows you who was wearing the pants in that company. But yeah, I think. Why are you smiling?
Who is wearing the trousers, man, not the pants?
I mean, we've kind of fallen into it. But yeah, I mean, I found it shocking that. I mean, it was first released in Japan in 1995. And then it was, I think, released like a year later in Europe.
Pre Resident Evil, that's one of the kind of.
Well, yeah, and pre Silent Hill. And there's still. I mean, I only was really exposed to it a few weeks ago, 2014, and I still find it kind of creepy and weird. It looks like an absolute pain to play, and it was very painful because it's all made for CGI, everything, and she's on a track. It's just so slow. Her clomp, 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 walking around the place. Turn, and if you want to get from A to B, you can't go from A to B, you have to go A, C, B to get anywhere.
Yeah, it's a real restrictive system.
It hasn't aged well, let's be nice. It hasn't aged well. In a sense, I was thinking, is it really ripe for remaking? But it's not. It's what's special about it is that it was there before them all. Because of the kind of cannibal element, I think it's a really. I mean, I really enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed the freakiness. Okay, it's, again, it has not aged well, but
there. Laura.
Yeah, the terrible voice.
Laura.
Okay, stop it, you're freaking me out. There's this one scene where she walks in to this room and she sees a man whose kind of arms are stretched out, and one arm is stuck out of a window and the other one is stuck through a wall, and he obviously it's a corpse. And then she goes into the next room where his hand ostensibly is, and there's a box there. And she opens the box, and you have to do a special stupid puzzle, the puzzles are stupid. And she opens it, and his hand is there with a ring, and you're like, don't touch the ring, don't touch the hand, that's disgusting, what's wrong with you? And she doesn't seem fazed at all, and she's got this like pink nail varnish, they've put a lot of detail into the nail varnish for some reason. She takes the ring, and kind of sort of, okay, you know, I'll keep that. And yeah, it's just really creepy.
You expect her to jump. You know, a jump scare,
yeah,
don't you?
She's but there's so very unfazed. Few. But then at the same time, she's having flashbacks about how she was eating her mum's arms. So I guess, you know, what's creepier, dead body or you remembering that you are well acquainted with corpses and killing people? I don't know.
She was brainwashed, wasn't she?
Her dad forced her to forget her memory somehow, because apparently that's what LA doctors do. They don't just do plastic surgery, they also dabble in memory modification. And actually, it's funny because he dabbles with, you know, he basically erases her memory somehow. And there's a blue compact that she carries. And apparently, I read this just recently, that in the blue compact, it appears again in D2. If you look into it, it has the ability to tell the future.
Oh, is that a kind of hint?
Yeah, thing? Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, that you say that, because you can get hints quite easily from the opening cutscene. Not the opening cutscene when you start the game. But
which is really impressive.
But the yeah, it is. But the pre-game, what you call it, when you switch on the game before the title screen comes
yes.
up, the cutscene there, it shows you the solutions to many the puzzles, a lot of them, where you see her put the paper into the water. It doesn't show you what it does, but it shows you clearly that you have to do that. And also you see her sliding a book onto a shelf. And you think, I wonder why she's doing that.
But that's the thing. All of the puzzles are just stupid. They're just really... I mean, I didn't mind the drawer puzzle. I didn't mind the water paper into
they,
blood.
That's the thing.
Those are okay.
When they... At the start...
That was fine.
They progressively get more and more...
No,
arcane.
Progressively. There's only one that's irritating, and it's the freaking turn the what is it called?
The wheel
round and round and round. That all the others were, you know, not brilliant, but they weren't terrible. That one.
This what you're talking about, this rotating room.
It's a rotating room that you control with a wheel that is completely randomly generated every time you start the game.
But as you rotate the room, there's one doorway, which is where you came in from, and rotating it will sometimes will give you just a brick wall, other times it will show you another path, and there are four entrances. So in total, to get through, you have to rotate it something like 12 times. Each rotation takes at least 5 seconds or 10 seconds. It's really annoying. And then you have to, not only do you have to then rotate it, you then also have to turn around, which takes another 10 seconds to check and see if there's a room that's been revealed. Then you have to go in and check, is it that?
You've got
to write it down.
Which brings us to the reason why. Not only is it annoying, it's also time consuming, which is bad for a game that has probably one of the most unique features about it is the fact that you can't pause it. You can't save it. You have to complete the game in 2 hours or less, otherwise you instantly get game over. I mean, a lot of people seem like, two... And it's like, well, come on. If you like to play video games and you're enjoying a game, you most likely be quite happy to put in 2 hours.
If you know what to do, I think you can
beat the game in an hour. Yeah, you could do it in an hour and 15, maybe. Yeah, quite easily. Yeah. And it's the kind of game you'd want to play with a walkthrough just because it's slowness and you don't want to be retracing your steps.
I mean, that's the problem, I would say. The biggest problem is that the vast majority of that time is spent not really engaging with the game, but just moving, because the movement is so slow. God forbid if you have to go back and revisit anywhere.
Oh, God.
I mean, the game is pretty good. There is a puzzle here, or there are two puzzles here. Solve them. Once you solve them, you go through, and
there's
then
progression.
There's some bullshit where the door slams shut behind you, or some boulder stops you from getting back.
That's what I did not understand. Her dad keeps going, get out, turn back. And it's like, where the hell is Laura going to turn back to? Sorry, can you just bring the weird gelatinous blob for her to go back through? Or should she, shove the boulder out of the way? Should she cut through the bars? Like, every area she goes to, it seems like there's something that's stopping her. I mean, the fact is, it starts in the kind of modern day. She's driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Did you not receive this bit at the beginning?
No,
okay, well, because don't forget, Kenji Ino loves San Francisco.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And do you remember the story behind that?
He went to this thing in San Francisco and he really liked it. And that's why he went with for the 3DO.
That's it. Yeah, and that's
where they were based.
I think that's the reason why he chose San Francisco to LA. But anyway, if she goes in, she finds all these dead people in the corridor. And
goes into where?
Into the hospital. And the police have kind of asked her to come and bargain with crazy doctor, her dad. And it's interesting.
Can we tell this again?
Okay, I'll stop.
Hold on, I'm just going to move as well.
Getting a bit stiff like Laura. When I first saw the first scene, the very beginning of the game, she's driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles to the hospital that her dad works in and supervises. She's been called by the police because they're trying to calm him down. He's gone on a killing spree, even though apparently he's usually a quiet and studious man or whatever. And then when she goes in to the hospital, didn't you just get a moment of, oh my God, it's just like Silent Hill?
Oh yeah.
I was like, wow, it looks just like the first Silent Hill.
It's even got that kind of realistic detail of no beverages, no food.
Yeah, which is obviously a bit of a wink to the fact that she eats her mum. Don't you think?
Probably.
That's, very bad joke.
That's pretty twisted, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was just quite shocking. Like, obviously with Silent Hill, it's really creepy, but the kind of... Do you know what it is, actually? I know what it is. What makes it creepy for me is the intimacy. Because this is quite a gothic tale in that it's about a mum, a dad, a daughter, and this kind of very twisted story about an ancestorial link to Dracula, breaking the spoilers.
Isn't it, they're not related, but doesn't Dracula takes over the father?
No,
turned him into a vampire?
No. Did you not hear what he said? He says that the dad at the end explains that they have the blood of Dracula running within them, and to complete the transformation...
Which doesn't necessarily mean that their ancestors.
Am I just overanalyzing this?
Yeah, I really don't know, because
I'm not sure
if it even makes sense, because he's transforming into Dracula. He's possessed by Dracula. He needs Laura. Why does he need Laura?
Because Laura is also related to Dracula.
Yeah, but so why isn't Dracula alive?
Okay, let's start from the beginning. Dracula isn't real. Okay, next
Dracula
point.
Dracula is real.
Next point. Kenji Ino is making the rules for his Dracula, and those are the rules. Okay? It's not a real story.
Is
Laura isn't a real person. She's a digital actress, which I didn't even realise was a thing.
No, I'm not.
Until this. But yeah.
The story makes no sense, all right? The start of it does, although that's the good thing about it, is that the premise makes perfect sense.
And
it's really cool and creepy and weird. Like you said, the intimacy of it.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Family tale.
Well, it's the gothic thing about a kind of... this idea of eating your mother. It's kind of, this kind of cannibalism, but it's specifically that it's a horror in the household. And then it's also the fact that it's set in a hospital, but it's set in a... You know, then it seems to go into some kind of Baroque medieval... kind of home,
yeah,
Dracula's home, and it's very strange. I mean
she's in, what happens, she goes in to the hospital entrance waiting room, then this weird portal appears and sucks her in, and then she's in this ancient manor, and it's never explained.
Dracula's home is what I think it is.
Yeah, probably.
And there's all these allusions to blood, so the water, one of the puzzles is that you place a piece of paper you find in a bowl of water that turns to blood. And another is that there's a massive casket, and I think you're kind of meant to go, inside this big casket is blood as well. And it's very, very creepy. And I think, yeah, the intimacy, it gives it a very different feel to Silent Hill games. So it's definitely a predecessor, but it's by no means kind of comparable directly in a sense. And
they're very different.
They're very different.
The gameplay in this
you
is
can't
so...
die.
No, that's true. Yeah, you can't die. The game, so it is very much like an adventure game.
Yeah, it's not even survival horror, because you're not surviving.
Yeah. The penalty, you know, it's a really weird bit, because none of it is action-oriented, except for one bit where there is a quick time event, or several quick time events in a row, you know, of Laura's got to dodge from an attacker. And if you lose, you don't die.
You just have to start again.
Yeah, you just lose a bit of time. So it's all about kind of racing against the clock and doing it that way. No, there's no risk of dying. The only way you die is if you run out of time.
I think that most people would say that it's an interesting game, but it's not one that you should go out of your way to play.
Would you recommend it?
Do you know what? I think I kind of would for people that are diehard Silent Hill fans and who really enjoy a kind of experience as opposed to... or just enjoy video gaming history, which is why I really enjoyed it, because I really love the stories of where it came from and stuff. But particularly because Kenji Ino, like as we were saying at the beginning, it's more about the innovativeness and the ingenuity. And everyone keeps going, oh, it's a shame that there are not more people like him. But what they mean is that they're more interesting, kind of... the bad boy of video games. There's not more of those types of people about who are fascinating, basically, who are kind of tortured geniuses or whatever. And I mean, when you read this one-up interview of him, it is quite clear the interviewers are not in control of the interview. I mean, there's one point where he starts to talk about how he kind of jokingly says that he doesn't think that Al-Qaeda had bombed the Twin Towers, and actually America did it, and the interviewers are like, okay, back to video games.
Yeah, let's...
I think you're forgetting that we're American. Anyway, back to video games. And there are several points... Okay, that's the biggest, most glaring one, where he just goes off on one about how he went on this massive depressive streak, and then a video game came out of it. And we didn't even talk about the fact that he's into music. And
oh, he did the music. Actually, one of the things I was going to say about why D is atmospheric is that I really like the sound effects and the music. There's a really great sound effect when you go into your inventory, you select an item, and if it's the correct item, it goes, and it's just a really little touch, but it's really atmospheric, the noise, and somehow it makes the whole game feel creepy, even though it is completely janky.
I love that that's not a word. Janky.
You love that it's not a word. It is a word.
That's not a word.
Yeah, janky's a word.
No, it's not.
All right, it's not janky. Sorry, I'll use a real word. It's juggly.
Doesn't make sense.
Juggly. Like.
But yeah, he's a kind of... I mean, that was one of his loves, music. And I love that he has these massive depressive streaks and he's so creative within them. I mean, he sounds like he's got bipolar syndrome. And that's fascinating. I think there's something really fascinating about someone who's, you know, basically unstable. But from it comes a lot of interesting creative stuff.
I think it probably helps that there were only about 7 people working who worked on D.
Mm.
I didn't write it down exactly, but he did the sound... and the music, he did the kind of the game design, he was the director, producer. He basically took on the vast majority of the workload for the game, and obviously he did all the cutscenes himself.
Like Tommy Wiseau for The Room.
Yeah, he's an entrepreneur like Tommy Wiseau. Do you really want to compare him to Tommy Wiseau? Is Tommy Wiseau the best possible person? No, he's not the best possible
person. But I really love him.
This is not the Tommy Wiseau podcast.
They have similar hair. I feel a bit bad. Okay, let's...
This isn't the Tommy Wiseau podcast. Oh my God.
If only. Anyway, would you recommend it?
I had a good time watching it on the Let's Play. Big part of the reason the Let's Play that we watched had some good commentary. That really helps to kind of ease the really, really slow walk and those really slow movements in general.
I want to throttle her by the end of the game. By the end of the game, I don't care if Dracula sucks her blood. I'm like, take her. She's slow. So this is what Survival of the Fittest is all about. The slow ones get it picked off.
It is a miracle she lived so long.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Well,
she wouldn't make it in a teen slasher, no way.
All I want to know is how slow was her mother. I mean, I love. Those scenes where she's just like, stab, stab,
stab again.
And then when she's eating the arm,
I'm going to eat you now. Time to die.
And the mother's like, no, Laura, no. And then by that point, she's lost one of her arms. Do you know what I read as well today? The kind of story that's given to it is that she's found by police, amputated, like her legs and her arm, stabbed to death.
The mother?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's really fucked up, isn't it? So any final thoughts?
The Let's Play is good because of the commentary. Also, another alternative would be not condoning illegal methods, but... play it on an emulator. That way you can speed it up. Speed up the emulator speed. And I think if you sped it up to about 4 times or 5 times, you'd have a very fast game. But I think you'd have quite a playable one. So I think that would be my recommendation. It's a pretty good game, but it's more good as a curiosity. But it was well worth playing, or watching, I should say. It's just fascinating, and the atmosphere is...
Yeah,
it's just really nice to kind of... You can kind of soak in it.
Yeah, I actually would compare it to Shadow of Memories, which is one of my favourite games of all time.
For what? The atmosphere?
I actually think that the game actually refers to D in some small way, because of the fact that it's all about, in a sense, travelling... you know, to different locations, different spaces.
Through time.
Through time, yeah. And specifically the feel, because obviously Shadow Memories is a very early PS2 game, so it doesn't look great.
And it has almost no gameplay.
And exactly, that's the point. It has no gameplay, and it's about kind of puzzles, and it's about going back and forth, and I feel like, and the redness, and there's something about the atmosphere, and there's something about the kind of feel of the game, the kind of intrigue. I mean, I find D is extremely intriguing, and I wish there was a story to back it up. The fact that it's just Dracula at the end is a bit like, okay, well, that was random. But I feel like they could have done a bit more with that. But then again, it was Kenji Ino on his own doing the CGI by himself. So, you know, what can you expect from him, really?
It was more about the shock factor of there's cannibalism.
And it's still shocking.
Do you think so?
I think so. I thought it was really creepy and weird. Maybe you're just desensitised.
Maybe. All right, yeah, that's going to wrap it up. We're going to put a lid on this one. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's going to do us for this week, for this time. We will be back again in another 2 weeks. And we'll have more games, more weird stories, more blog posts. It's more of everything. Okay. Yeah. Bye. You know when vampires turn their victims?
No,
transfer their blood.
No, hang on, let me finish.
Sorry.
I feel bad now, but anyway, it's just because there's a microphone, I won't feel bad otherwise. But basically, the dad says...
Can we tell this again?
Okay, I'll start.
Hold on, I'm just going to move as well.
Getting a bit stiff like Laura. So basically...
She's square, by the way.
I know, what is up with that? It's like they animated freaking beautiful... chandeliers and beautiful paintings, and they couldn't make a woman with, you know, a normal waist.
Have you got enough, Adrian? Stupid editor.